EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merge 295. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Did we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
County dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls.
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show. How are you all doing? I'm Nick Hunter and you're listening to the UFO Chronicles podcast. Tonight we meet Bridget from the United Kingdom. And Bridget has worked with many of the world's leading researchers of alien abductions, including the late Bud Hopkins, Dolores Cannon and John Mack. And tonight she will be speaking about some of her own personal encounters, including a close encounter on the 405 freeway in Los Angeles in 1993. Bridget is up next. But first, if you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to patreon.com/UFO Chronicles podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Hello, Bridget. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for allowing me to be on your podcast.
Thank you for coming on today and you're calling from the United Kingdom.
Yeah, with an accent like yours and mine. Yep, I am definitely here in the UK where it's cold, wet and windy.
Cold, wet and windy. Now, Bridget, you have some experiences you're going to be sharing with us. Would you like to start at the beginning, please, ma'am?
Yes. So from a very, very early age, I used to have paranormal experiences of the ghost kind. So I would have been about 6 at the time when I first saw my first ghost, which was very scary to see for the first time. I was staying at a friend's house and I was sleeping on her top bunk bed because I was the guest. I'd had no prior experiences with anything at that point. And I think that I was sort of like full blown into it from this experience. Late at night, top bunk, watching moths, bats fly outside, very old Victorian house in a very lovely little village in Devon. I believe Marnie herself was asleep at the lower bunk. And I was just watching what was going on with the streetlights and the moths. And then all of a sudden, a lady solidly appeared in the left-hand side of the room. And I remember sort of like looking, thinking, this is a lady, and she was in a chair, like a rocking chair, sort of the typical horror sort of scenario. And I just looked, and I kind of looked around the room, and the room had changed totally. It had totally gone back in time. Weavings on the wall, what would have been Marnie's wardrobe was no longer there. It would have been weavings on the wall. She was sitting in a chair, long sort of skirt dress, older lady. And I just remember looking at her, very frightened, sort of like, you know, when you have the covers right up to you, and looked at her. I don't know if she looked at me, but she was sort of, I didn't physically look her in the eyes or anything like that, but I just saw her. She then sort of went to touch the window and then she disappeared and the room went back to normal. It would have taken me a little bit of a while to go back to sleep because I was a bit frightened. Totally remembered it the next morning. I told Marnie, and then I remember us going downstairs for breakfast, and then I told excitedly, and yeah, sort of like couldn't believe what had happened to her mum, and everybody in the house had seen her before. So it was a validation that what I had witnessed was real. And at that point onwards, then the paranormal, the ghosts just constantly I would see them. So another encounter would have been with me and her, again, Marnie in the back garden. I think it was about 1977. It was the Silver Jubilee, because I remember the English mugs that were all given out. I was in her back garden. We had a tent in the back garden and sandwiches, probably cake at the time. I don't know. I just remember the sandwiches. We were lying down and her garden sort of sloped. Well, you could either, however way you looked at it, it either sloped up or it sloped down. But we were facing her house, and she had her house, a patio, quite a long patio, and a rockery, and then the garden and the grass. We were positioned to the right hand side of her garden with the tent flaps open, and it was dark. We were eating our sandwiches, talking. All of a sudden, we both saw little people. They would have probably, let's say, might have been, you know, half a meter in height, maybe a little bit smaller than that. And they were jumping in and out of the rockery. So they would be going on top of the big rocks and behind something, coming out from the other side of the rocks. I don't recall us interacting with them. We were just in awe with watching them, and they were clothed. We remembered it. Well, I remembered it. We both remembered it at the time, because I remember talking to Marnie about it. And my dad was very creative. We had a great childhood growing up. And I remember telling my dad. And my dad just said to me, you know, that's what happens at night. The little people come and pick up, tidy up the garden, so to speak. If there's anything like a dead mouse somewhere or something. The little people pick it up. And being, you know, like seven, you just think, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I had other experiences. It's obviously in the same village, same place I was living. With my experiences were in my room at night. I had an exercise that I used to do, which would have been an out-of-body exercise, which I would get excited to go to bed to meditate and things. I used to look around the room, used to go out of my body, float above myself, study my bedroom. Oh, I could move this, I could do that, I could do this. And then would go back into my body. Generally, if I heard movement coming up the stairs or something, but I always longed to, oh God, I'm so excited to go to bed and I could do that exercise again. And I used to do it a lot. I always remember other things in that room that didn't make sense, as opposed to ghost encounters. You know, whether it be the summertime, we had the big sash windows. They would be up, breeze coming in. I love the cool air coming in. But one stage, little people being on my windowsill. And that always wasn't to me like a ghost. So the little people were never like ghosts. You could tell the difference between the little people and a ghost. They were more animated. They had energy. They could interact with you. They knew that you were there. They knew that you two were watching each other. As opposed to a ghost, it was a very slow process, a different form of energy, if that makes sense. It wouldn't be unusual to be found in the garden late at night by my parents or my brothers. I got told I used to sleepwalk a lot. I could get myself totally dressed into my riding gear and go out in the garden. So very conscious of what I was doing until, you know, got led back in. And then the next morning I said, really, did I? So I used to get found out in the garden. Then came what I always called the Chinese girl in the gazebo. That was a very unusual encounter. So looking back, even by me saying this to you, Nick, looking back, it was always about the other people. As in, we're not talking humans now. We're talking other, upright, intelligent, interactive, interdimensional, high strangeness people that were obviously intrigued by me. And I grew up in this little village where you could, everyone knew everybody. I decided to walk home a different way. It should have straight up the road, but I decided to go a different way one day. It led me to a place that would take me sort of like round about, sort of like a circle-ish home. And as I walked home, and it would have taken me down a lane and then up another lane to go to the house, I came across this girl. I'll always call her Chinese. She had dark, long hair. She had fringe. I think out in the States, you call it bangs. She had very unusual eyes. She was my height. I don't remember if she was clothed, but she was definitely clothed, you know. But she was something very different about her, as in, I'll say, her appearance, just her energy-wise. And she had something in her hand. I didn't communicate with her verbally. She didn't communicate with me verbally. So I would say this was the start of something very unusual, because she showed me something in her hand. It was flat. It was paper-like. It was big. So like, you know, like we had the old £10 notes and £5 notes or the old £50 notes and stuff like that. It was big. She showed me something. Now, she's not going to have £50 note, but it was something. And she was showing it to me. And it was quite important that she was showing it to me. And then she sort of like put her hand out and then pointed sort of like over to the side and up a little bit, as if to say, well, that's my house. That's where I live. And it was sort of like nodded my head and I walked home. Didn't, you know, I don't know, you know, my mum was foreign. So if there was something my mum didn't understand, I'm sure visually someone would know, look, I don't understand it via body language, raising your shoulders or, you know, pulling that face or something like that. But I remember I moved off and carried on walking and walked home. You know, part of me kind of may have thought that I probably got home a little bit late. Where have you been? I don't know. But next day, I was very excited to go back to the same place to see if I could see this little girl. And I went back to where she showed me where she was, where she showed me her house was with her hand. It was up a little hill to a cul-de-sac. The house wasn't there. There was no house there. They were sort of like newly building or something. And there's a few houses there, but not where she showed me where a house is, where I remember sort of seeing where her house was the night before. And the next thing that I saw as I walked up to the house, thinking, you know, I can sort of like visually see it now, I was like, well, hang on a minute. But what was where her house would have been was this field. And this field was this object was there in this field, not far away from me at all, probably 8-10 meters away. I always call it the gazebo, the Chinese girl's gazebo, because it's a bit like now, it's quite cool, everyone to have a pagoda and, you know, all lit up at night, and maybe the jacuzzi off to the side, blah, blah, blah. But it was like that. It was this structure that had lights around it, and it was off the ground, and it was shimmering. I remember the shimmer from the lights onto the grass, and it was off the ground. It wasn't, you know, sat on the ground. It was slightly off the ground. I don't know if I remember any noise, don't remember anything like that. And I remember just looking at this, and then the only other memory that I have of it, of that situation, is grabbing hold of something solid, cold, as if, like, let's say you're waking up from a surgical procedure, you sort of like get yourself up, you hold on to the side of the table, you put your legs on the ground. And that's the visual that I, and physical memory feeling that I remember. So with having ghost experiences, and I've had many, like, absolutely extraordinary, full-blown physical ghost experiences, having the Chinese girl in the gazebo, the little people in the garden, and the little people at the windowsill, they didn't fit into the ghost scenario. So I kind of sort of always parked those thoughts in my head and thought, okay, I'll try and suss that out as I get a bit older. In the same house that I was living at, my dad was a potter and a sign writer. We had a big kiln room pottery at the top opposite, you know, as we walked out the back door. We had kiln rooms, we had barns at the bottom of the garden, we had an allotment at the bottom of the garden. There was an old pump well. I don't know when it first happened. I probably was about 7 or 8 again, 9 maybe. I would know that there would be a person at the bottom of the garden. I call him the man at the bottom of the garden, dressed all in black. It was sort of like telepathic. Wherever I was in the house or whatever, I would go to the kitchen window, past the arga, through to the kitchen window, this little kitchen window that then would look down. I think we had about an acre and a half of garden, and he would be there. Now, he'd be by the pump well that we had, and he would be dressed all in black, like an old fisherman, where you have the plastic gloss. It was matching top, bottom. Obviously, couldn't see his feet. He was just dressed all in black. And I suppose because my dad had boats, and, you know, and I could picture the like the old waders that you used to have. It was very much like that. And he was like military style. He would be right at the bottom of the garden, just hands down to his side, just staring up many a times. Because I would say because of the telepathy point of view, it had to be something high strangeness and it had to be something of the paranormal. Because it was a knowing that he would be there. And the knowing then would, let's say, if my brothers were in the house, my cousin was in the house, my brother's best friend, Andy, remembers it vividly. You know, he's here, he's back. And they would leg it down the garden to try and get him. Because, you know, it's a bit like that scenario of, is someone going to steal my sister who's on our ground? They would run after him and he would just totally disappear. I had witnessed him disappear by gliding. And it would be a backward motion, like a movie dolly, where you'd put the cameras on and they'd be on rails. He would be there, and then all of a sudden, you would just see him glide off back to the left where the barn was. And when I worked with Bud Hopkins, we looked into the man at the bottom of the garden. He was definitely a being. There's no two ways about it. At that time, I was having a lot of activity with other beings. They would take me. I remember some of this without the aid of hypnosis, and then obviously with Bud, a lot more came out. But I remember having beings working on me in my garden. I then, as I grew older, I then, a bit like yourself, Nick, wanted to be around other people that were having paranormal experiences. I used to start going to sort of like circle groups, psychic circles, to open myself up more, to understand why it was happening to me, to see if there's various exercises that I could do, or also sometimes learn to stop some of the things that were happening. You know, I could be in control of it and say no. So I was working with other mediums to, you know, try and understand that. Looking back, brilliant, I'm glad I did, but it sort of, there is a difference between ghosts and there is a difference between beings, but it is all interlinked. You can't have one without the other. It's all a learning tool and it's all an energetic learning tool to sort of fine tune you. So growing up, 17, 18, 19 in London, I moved up to London, was with my partner, going to development circles with his mum. She loved all the paranormal stuff. I'd had an encounter with my ex, a UFO encounter, and I need to state, everyone thinks you've got to go outside to see a UFO. Nope. We had had this meal out and we'd just got back. We started to lie down on the bed, just like comatose through, like eating a big steak meal. We were lying down on the top of the covers, just the head up looking at the ceiling, thinking, oh, full bellies. And then all of a sudden, this object, solid object, black with white lights all intricately in it, lit up, little lights started to come from where our, I suppose, you know, our knees were over the end of the bed, started to float above us. So it was above us on the ceiling. So we watched it float over us, over our stomachs, over our heads. and then into the back wall and then out of the wall. So that was my encounter with Billy. And thinking about it now, just as I say it, the connection there between me and Billy to maybe have another encounter, which obviously is the encounter that I'll talk about shortly in Los Angeles. So I don't remember any other UFO encounters at that stage, but a couple of years later, I go over to Los Angeles to work, and some of my friends from my hometown in Exmouth at the time had gone over there to live. And I thought, oh, great, I'll go and visit them and things, in which I did, and loved America so much, I ended up staying there for a bit. But people say you've got to be careful what you wish for. Years and years later, I was still having paranormal activity. I wasn't having any UFO activity at the time, but I had a call from my mum, and I remember it at sort of like Christmas birthday time. And mum said to me, someone's going to give you a call, in which the next call that I had was Billy. And he said to me, so this was in 92. So my birthday in December 92. He said he wants to come over and visit. I'm like, fantastic. Yeah, that'd be lovely. Come over and visit. So he didn't come over till maybe January at the time, 93 now. And I was kind of like nervous because we had been like, sweethearts. Years had gone by for him. Years had gone by for me. I thought of to myself, well, you've got to kind of be careful what you wish for. And I didn't know what was going to happen. So he came over. He was living with me in the valley in Los Angeles in the Woodland Hills. His friend from England, Kelly, wanted to come over and visit. She wanted to come over and work, find job opportunity. I said, look, sure, she can get an apartment in the same apartment complex as us. There's quite a few going, because it was called Oakwood Apartments at the time. Little did I know, there was lots of famous people that used to live there, the Brat Pack people. It was pretty much the cool place to sort of like be living. And as they were all starting up, it's not like cost loads of money to live there or anything like that. But it was, the apartments were all done up inside and everything. So anyway, Kelly had come over to stay, and she had an interview on Rodeo Drive. And to me, that isn't a regular day in Los Angeles, because I never went to Rodeo Drive, never even bought anything in Rodeo Drive, out of the valley or, up Melrose Avenue. That's where I shopped, or the Beverly Center. So I had taken her for a job interview on Rodeo Drive, parked the car in the complex where it was. We got into the car. I remember driving down the multi-story car park. We drove back out to get onto the 101 405 freeway to go back to the valley. We chatted about our job interview and things. And then I had to go to an area called Brentwood. Now, I had been to Brentwood at the time, and I gone there. There was an old theatre there because my friends were in like the movie business. So I had been to Brentwood, but I don't know the area. I just would have gone to that movie theatre there at that time. So as we were approaching the sort of to get off the off ramp, the freeway, I'm feeling really, really nervous. I'm feeling really, really apprehensive. Something's absolutely building in my stomach. It's not the fact that I have to go to this girl's house and I have to get home and I'm in a rush or anything like that. It's none of that. There's something very, very different that is happening to me. I have no clue what it is or no control over it. It's getting stronger and stronger. So as I get off the freeway, my hands are so glued to the steering wheel. They were glued to the steering wheel. Build up, butterflies, anxiety, something's happening, something's changing, and I don't know what it is. And as I come off the off-ramp, I'm then at a point where the traffic lights are in front of me. Holiday Inn is to the left. UCLA College is a little bit to the right. And I'm at a traffic light. There is a car in front of me, and I'm not sure if there's a car in front of that. But my windows are wound down because it's been a nice day, and it's about 10 to 6 at night. I'm at a stoplight. So car in front of me, and all of a sudden I remember seeing something very quick, very silver to the left of me, very quickly. And I remember looking, something silver, and no sooner as that had happened, now I've got this 45 50 foot craft that's right on top of the trunk of the car in front of me. Now, I didn't see it leap from the left to my driver's side, sort of like little area of the door window, to thing right in front of me. But there it was. And it was stationary at this point of me having my first look at it. And it is above the trunk of the car in front. So close, I want to touch it. I mean, God, if I'd opened the car, got out, walked over to the car in front of me, got on the trunk, got on the roof, it would have been a hand span away from it. It was just that low. And so I now can't hear anything. Everything's gone silent. Now, you've got to remember, I've still got my hands on my wheel. I'm now looking at this object and it's so quiet out there. I can't hear anything. This thing of that size would have made a noise. It's also got no fuelage coming from it, no exhaust. It's also got no wings, and it has this amazing red-orange power source underneath it. It is just like you're looking into an ember of a fire. I'm looking at it, and it isn't until that point, with my hands gripped to the steering wheel, just you couldn't prise them off, Nick. I mean, I'm just like, you could be the world's strongest man. You wouldn't take my hands off the steering wheel. Because my nose is pretty much to the windscreen and I'm looking underneath this craft, I then swear. So I've got Kelly next to me and I then go, what the F is that? She is then, because back then we had mobile phones, right? I think we were on pagers. So it's not like she sat in the car like they do now with on your phone or anything like and not looking up. Whatever it was, I swore, she's now looking at it and now she's staring at this thing. This object now, craft, moving, unusual. It was just gliding slowly. Now it's gliding slowly over, would have gone over the roof of that car. Then it would have gone over to the right. Did it go a little bit higher? It must have done, because as it's moving over to the right, the traffic lights go back on again. So whether this craft stopped the lights, as we know that that happens, I then put my foot on the gas again to move, still being shaken. I'm not speaking to her. I don't know if she's looking at it, because I'm just like, one, you've got to know that you've got to drive a car, and you've got to go somewhere, and then you've got this object that you're trying to go round in your head like a cog. Where have I seen something like this before? Hang on a minute, it's got no wings, it's got no fuel, it's got this, you know, and you're trying to spin every idea and every whatever it could be in your head. My foot goes on the gas because the car in front of me is moving. I am told in my head that I can't go right. I cannot go right. And I'll come to that in a minute. I then go to the left to go over the bridge that takes you directly over the freeway, right? So you've got the freeway underneath you, and then you've got the Holiday Inn, which as you're going over the bridge would be on the right-hand side. Big, round Holiday Inn. I remember going over, so it's going over towards UCLA College, just going by the trees. I remember turning the car to go left to go over the bridge. I remember looking in the back window of the car. And I remember what I'll always say is the back arse of it going through the tops of the trees. Can't say it any more simpler than that. Literally, the ends of the craft going through the tops of the trees. It was phenomenal. And I remember it. So that was low, right? The trees weren't high up. They were green at the time. And I then remember having to turn my head to drive over the bridge because I got a car in front of me. Told that I can't make a right and I got to get up high. It was very matter of fact, very broadly spoken to me. Got to get up high and you've got to go and you can't go right. Now, I always say this, could be my subconscious. It could be a subconscious thing. So I just knew that I could go up and drive up behind the Holiday Inn, up the side road there and go up to the top of the Holiday Inn and then have a great vantage point to look out. Now, I don't know the Holiday Inn at all. I'd never been there. I've never been up the top of that road. I drove like literally not even a block where it was as soon as you get off the freeway. I drove up a lane. So I drove up to the top, me and her not talking still, circled the car around because it was a little cul-de-sac on this little lay-by. And I said to her, we're both going to get out at the same time, point in the same direction where it went. She got out her side, which was on the right-hand side. I got out my side, which was on the left-hand side. And I said, right, we're both going to point in the same direction. She pointed with her left hand, I pointed with my left hand, and we both pointed in the same direction, which would have been now. Our hands would have been pretty much hovering over the Holiday Inn, pointing in the direction of UCLA. And wow, well, let me tell you, at that point, the reality of something had happened. Now, from the vantage point of being up high, could we see it? No, I couldn't see anything that would resemble something that vast size going anywhere. Couldn't see anything at all. I felt sick. My eyes were streaming. I was shaking. I remember we got back in the car, down the hill, made a right, probably, I don't know how many blocks away it was. It wasn't far. It was minutes away to this girl's house that I had to go to on the corner. I drove into her apartment complex and then got out of the car, not looking around, didn't want to look at anything. My eyes, I can say, felt like they'd been stretched wide open. I didn't want to look at anything. I looked at the ground. I just didn't want to look around anything. I remember holding onto the side of the car. I felt drunk. I'd never drank alcohol. Couldn't think. Didn't want to think. I remember ringing the doorbell. She came out. I said to her, listen, something really has strange has just happened to me. I need to get back. I need to go. I got back into the car, went to drive out of her drive, because you drive in one way and drive out the other way, and there in front of me was this amazing black gangster car, sort of like a really old black 50s car. Now Hollywood, Los Angeles, has a lot of picture vehicles, ones that go into, you know, all the TV shows and films, so it wouldn't be unusual to see an absolutely stunning car driving around, you know, LA or around that way. But this car was very low profile, black tinted. It was there, and I had a, I suppose, body shock again, as I was told it's been placed here to remember. So again, very verbally coming from somewhere, very matter of fact, you can't go right, you got to get up high, and this has been put here for you to remember. So now I've got this black car right in front of me. It's there for a while, and it makes me, you know, for a few minutes, it makes me feel really uneasy. And why is that there? So it's been placed for me here to remember. It then went back into the traffic, still not feeling myself, get back into the traffic within, like I say, let's just call it like 5 blocks away back from the freeway. I then start to go off the off ramp to go down the freeway. And because my windows are wound down, I can hear this roaring noise. Me and Kelly not talking at all. There's no communication between us whatsoever. Looking up and seeing a helicopter, a black, very low, because I can see the rivets on this helicopter, unmarked, 4 or 5 military helicopters. So as I was going on the off ramp of going back onto the freeway, as the crow flies, it's heading in that direction of UCLA. But within 10 minutes, right, you got military helicopters going straight over to where this is. Still not talking to her on the way home. Your brain's trying to put anything into context. The thing that baffled me the most was the size of it, no wings, the heaviness of it, the power, whatever was powering it, that red orange underneath, yeah, and the closeness of it. So we drive back to my apartment, put my stuff down. Billy's at the flat. Billy's in my apartment, who'd had the experience with the craft going above bed. It isn't unusual when you hear it, and you hear it time and time again, you want to say something. I couldn't say it. A bit like the girl that I go to her house. I couldn't say it. Physically, mentally, emotionally wrecked at that point. Other things do I remember from that night? First of all, her walking into the bathroom, her looking at a reflection of me. I look at a reflection of her, and I know getting into bed that night didn't feel right at all. You know, I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to, you know, do anything. I didn't, you know, no TV or nothing. I just needed to get into, you know, just to my own space. I wish I could remember more of that. And let's say physical evidence or anything. Physical evidence I did definitely go through, with the emotion of eyes burning, the interaction within my body. Now, Nick, I never had a conversation with Kelly about it. I never did. And I suppose that's possibly why I always went public, because how amazing would it be for that person to come forward, validate things, and to share that experience with again? I went public, my own extraordinary encounter, and I wanted her, maybe one day, well, she hasn't yet, but now everybody's listening to all these things, she might go, oh my God, that's her. I had my encounter with her. That would be just like amazing. But we know that it can affect everybody psychologically in a different way. I suppose I'm a little bit more proactive, and I'd had years of UFO experiences. Maybe she hadn't. I don't know, because I never communicated with her. So a couple of days later, she moved out of the apartments. That's all I know. A couple of days later, I told Billy, I got to go. I just got to get out of here. You know, you go to stay with my friend. I'm going to go to Santa Cruz for a couple of weeks, kept my apartment on, and, you know, just need some headspace, in which I did.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
I then go and stay in Santa Cruz for possibly a week, week and a half. I go with a friend, and they're moving a trailer back from Santa Cruz all the way to Topanga Canyon. Now, Topanga Canyon in 93, little did I know it was a UFO hotspot. So I'm sort of like now being plumped into the epicenter of it all. And having some very unusual high strangeness in Topanga Canyon. I remember having some unusual encounters in Topanga Canyon that don't fit into the normal. There was one thing that was very personal to me that involved I had to go to the doctors for, that involved something that was very unusual, and I still have my medical records for that. There was an encounter that I had in Topanga Canyon. So let's just say maybe three weeks, you know, after my encounter on the freeway. I'm at a friend's house in Topanga and I'm looking through their books. I'm a huge book collector. Looking through their books, and they have a book called Bringers of the Dawn, Teaching from the Pleiades. And I look at that, I went, oh my God, I know that. Why do I know that word? Why do I know those words? Picking it up, flicking through. My friends are playing music. Live music, sort of like strumming, bit of singing, and I'm heading my books, listening, and then all of a sudden, like having a huge psychic experience placed in front of my mind's eye. But like, let's say if I was looking at you, Nick, I can't see you. I've just got a TV monitor in front of me. So you've now turned into a TV monitor. I'm being shown frequencies, and those frequencies, I am hearing these tones, these high pitched tones, and with those tones, those frequencies that I'm shown on this monitor are going up, down, fat, thin. I was shown this in my head, and I was having these tones that go with it. Now, I know, even though I say to you I couldn't hear that object on the freeway, something must have gone on, because as soon as I heard those tones, I put them back to where I was on the freeway in Brentwood. I knew that craft was outside. I said to the guys, I said, can you not hear that? And they just like looked at me. It's like, no. But Seth said to me, I don't know if I remember he'd have, I don't remember if he'd had UFO encounters, but for him to have Teachings of the Pleiades, Bringers of the Dawn on his bookshelf, you know, he must have had walked on this journey with a bit of insight. He said, you know what you can hear? Go outside. And I'm like, oh, Christ. This has only happened two, three weeks ago. I don't know if I want to. It was a huge pull in. It's like I was being pulled to go out. And I remember getting up, going so far to where the door was, and he had a stable door at the time. I just knew if I stepped outside, I'm going to be under a craft again. I didn't. I resisted it. Let's sort of go back. If we go back to the freeway, I've spoken a bit about Bud Hopkins. I went in, well, 97, I worked with Dolores Cannon, and I had hypnosis with Dolores Cannon. I spent a couple of days with Dolores, wonderful lady, huge following still, which is amazing, and her publishing company and what her daughter's doing. And under the hypnosis, we went back to my childhood, and we did go back to part of the freeway encounters, but she did mainly of the older experiences I had. And I was being blocked big time, because when I came back from America in 93, the latter part of 93, I was just suffering from headaches, like cluster headaches, and also suffering from hair loss. So I recall going to my doctor And I was very honest with him. I said, look, I've had a massive UFO encounter. I was underneath a craft and he treated me. It's in my medical records. He treated me for radiation, you know. And I then went with Nick Pope in, I can't remember if it's 97, 98. I think it was 98. Went to work with Bud Hopkins in New York. We were there for 5 days. I think I did 3 or 4 days of hypnosis with Bud. Alongside us was Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins used to help out in Intruders Foundation, do a lot of research for Bud. Still, you know, so still been great friends to this very day. He's absolutely a legend in ufology and knowledge. We did hypnosis and we went back to the past stuff. We went back to the freeway. So the freeway, under the hypnosis, I'm at the steering wheel. I'm got my hands on the steering wheel, gripped very, very tightly. And the feeling in my body of just the tingle, the fuzz, the energy, the static, whatever was going on, and the grip onto the steering wheel, that's where it blacks out. So what happened under the hypnosis, if you remember, I'm gripping the steering wheel, I'm looking up at this, at that point it goes black. I am then going through my body, fragmented like atoms. Every part of my body is then being sucked through the steering wheel, through the central component dash of my dash in front of me behind my wheel. I'm going through every single part of that, bit by bit, molecule by molecule, going through the engine, being taken through that engine. My body's feeling going through that engine. It's in pieces, going through that engine and then being going up. I'm then placed again in a field and I have beings with me. I have light beings with me. And those light beings are pink, iridescent light beings, human formed, eyes, had hair. Hair that was like a transplant, white, long, you know, past the shoulders in parts as a transplant. I could seeing their veins, pink, blue veins like we have, just the energy of them. And the energy had a ring around it. And they had, it was one, I was now in one big ring with them. I felt that I knew these beings and I've seen these beings before. Now, these beings weren't the beings that I saw when I was, well, they were, it was the same vibration. So I felt that I knew them. I felt that I knew these beings. And one of them had a baby. Now, Nick Pope sat in on the hypnosis sessions, took lots and lots of notes. It was all recorded, got all of the recordings and stuff. And very traumatic, don't get me wrong. Anyone that's having to relive something that there are so many pieces missing, and then boom, you'll put a picture in front of your head and you know that it resonates with you, is a shocker. You fight it. You think, is that me? Is that my subconscious? You know, but then there are lots of other things. And the one of the strangest things about the hypnosis, what I found always very strange, was Kelly. She's in the back seat of the car under the hypnosis, and she wasn't to the right of me anymore. Now, looking back, but she was next to me as I drove over the bridge. Because I know which side of the car she came out. She didn't drive out. She didn't climb over the, you know, the back seat of the car and then, you know, lifted up the front seat and then get out. No, she was in the front. But in the hypnosis, she was in the back. And that freaked me out. So presentation. There was a child. One of the beings had a baby. I knew that that baby wasn't mine. I was very aware. So they call it, I suppose, like the child presentation, don't they? That baby was not mine. That presentation, or that, I suppose, let's say presentation of beings in I'm in company with, was about them. I felt such love from them and a knowing, a deeper knowing and a deeper understanding of probably other encounters, that that baby wasn't mine. It was about the beings. And I'll always say that because Bud, you know, he worded it very well. He didn't, I suppose they say, lead you or anything like that. He asked it in various different ways throughout the hypnosis, back and forth. No, that being with the baby wasn't my baby at all. It was about the beings. What I have, when I've had other experiences with beings next to me physically that I consciously remember, and I consciously remember beings being next to me quite a few occasions. It was about the beings. It was that blessed to have worked with. And then obviously John Mack, backwards and forth with emails with him, you know, going to set something up to be able to go and work with him as well, to explore further avenues with John and Piers, I think it was called, wasn't it, that John did. That never came into fruition at all, but, you know, documented lots of things with him and chatted with him and things. So that was the encounter. I had obviously go back to the Topanga encounter. After that, there were strange things that did happen in Topanga Canyon. Didn't know it was a UFO hotspot. I would go out to the general store in Topanga Canyon and there would be a big poster. Have you seen any UFOs in Topanga Canyon? I was like, what? I saw a poster then hanging up with a UFO on it in Topanga Canyon. I'm like, well, yeah, I know what happened to me like 3 weeks ago. I remember taking them down and they were on telephone poles. I remember taking them down. I took a couple, I think. And it was Preston Dennett back at the time that put them up there. So this is, we're talking February, March, April. We're talking March, April 93. And I was taking them down. And it wasn't until I went back to England and, you know, 93, I came back, 94, kind of just trying to sort my head out, coming back to England. On the top of my mind was always the UFO stuff. Then 95, started looking into it a bit more. We didn't have the internet so much as of then. And then we had the, you know, UFO reality sightings magazine, Encounters magazine, that was available in WH Smith's and the news agents. I was buying those. Weirdly, one of the, I think it was in Sightings magazine, was published in Exeter, where I was living at the time, decided to start up a witness support group with a few people, a few other experiences. And how it came about was I had put in the local newspaper, a bit like yourself, Nick, wanting to be around other people that had had other encounters of the paranormal, just wanted to meet fellow other people, just have a general chit chat. And I would then start it. I got a PO box, and then my PO box was like just stacked to the hilt of like people, experiences, you know, abductees write to me from all over England. Oh, and actually, it's not just all over England, because it went to many, many countries, those, you know, and I'd be getting letters left, right, and centre. So I started I got a questionnaire together. And if I go back to 96, October 96, I wrote to a gentleman from MUFON at the time. I think he was State Director of California. His name was Walt Andreas. He's well known within the field. I remember calling him, having a phone conversation with him that is recorded and I still have, of telling him about my UFO encounter at Brentwood on the freeway. And he was very matter of fact, suppose, you know, was quite incredible. It involved, you know, a craft, a men in black car, a military helicopter. It doesn't really happen. Well, it does. Somebody else has just gone forward that has had a fantastic UFO encounter, and that involved craft, military helicopters, and a men in black car. Raphael has got I think he's on Prime, Calling All Beings. You can go and watch and hear his and his wife's encounter with military helicopters intercepting a craft with a men in black car. So I can remember hearing his thinking, oh my God, this is amazing. So there has to be a report, military report, from the helicopters that were intercepting it. So something exists somewhere. And obviously with disclosure coming out now and us fighting for it more, you know, I've talked about this for 26 years, right? How amazing is it for me now, you know, to be a bit more in the public eye, to say, hang on a minute, you know, it's all very well for you to talk about your military helicopters and your pilot. Hang on a minute, a report somewhere on my encounter. If we go back to Walt Andreas and the phone call in 96, I remember him being very matter of fact. I then filed a report with him, sent a report over, I think 5 or 6 page report. You know, I did what I needed to do of my encounter. And then I went to a conference in Bristol with an abductee that, ironically, there's no such things as, you know, weirdness in this business except for the high strangeness. I witnessed where this lady lives. I witnessed craft going over towards her house, and they were the silver balls that we all see on the, like, stills now. They were very large. They were like sea mines, and they were going towards our house. So a couple of days later, I was introduced to her. She said, I said, "Ooh, I saw some things going over to her house." Anyway, cut a long story short, her abduction happened in Bristol the weekend of Rendlesham Forest, which is phenomenal because we know Rendlesham happened over 3 days. And her abduction with other people up on this, I think it's called Windmill Hill, if I remember rightly. They, load of people that were walking there, all ended up having the same encounter, stillness, and having a craft over them. And then, you know, went lots of physical encounters with it. And then they went on their way in a daze on the weekend, same weekend as Rendlesham Forest. So I started a UFO group with her, Helen, and another lady called Kathy. And it just got more and more popular. So we went to a conference. Nick Pope was there, guy from the Ministry of Defence. He's in all of these magazines and interviews these people. And this is what he does for a living. I need to talk to him. You know, so I waited until he'd finished talking to various other people like myself. And I introduced myself and I said, listen, you know, I had an encounter in America. And I don't think I told him about at that time about any of my other encounters. But this is what happened. Held military helicopters and men in black car. And he was interested. He was intrigued. And we exchanged. I think he gave me the desk number and email and everything, which I still have. And phone number of the desk that he was working at. And I had then had something put in the newspaper, you know, starting up a witness support group. And they made me and Kathy and Helen look like we wear tinfoil hats, right? With antennae on us. And I just thought, you know what? I'm not going to be laughed at. So I contacted Nick Pope. I said, listen, they've published something in the newspaper. I'm not happy with it. Can you stick up for us? Because this does happen. In which Nick did. And that was the start of mine and Nick's friendship and looking into my encounters more and more. So that, 96 to now, you know, I've spoken at various, well, they would have been the old Leeds conferences and ExoPolitics. In 2011, I did my presentations with Nick Pope as he interviewed me and a presentation talking about my encounters. And since then, have I had more UFO encounters? Yes. Every experience has been very, very different. No two are the same. One thing that I will say regarding the encounter in Holiday Inn was at the ExoPolitics conference in 2011, I had somebody, a gentleman from the audience, put his hand up because obviously there was visuals along with the presentation. I had a picture of the apartment that I went to and someone put their hand up and went, do you know what that number is? And I didn't even look at it, to be honest. I went, nope. And this is back in 2011 I did this, right? It was the exact date of 9/11. So out in America, you put your month, your date, and then your year. And that's what it was, month, date, and year, which was quite remarkable, really. As you could say, well, that's just a coincidence. I don't know. It was just a bit bizarre. Now, also in regards to the encounter in Brentwood, there is another high strangeness that is undeniable. When I had another UFO encounter many, many, many years later, where I was living in Devon, I was working at an all-boys school. And I'll say this quite quickly, but I was working at an all-boys school. I was on radio link with the other members of staff early morning, and I was reading a book by Courtney Brown. It was about remote viewing, and it was probably about 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. I remember having read it, put it down, because I felt compelled to go to the window. Got up on the sofa, went to the window, and I saw these silver balls that people are seeing now. I've seen so many of these in a few places in the world. I saw a couple in McMinnville when I was there with two other experiences. I've seen them with my eldest son, Orion, many of them. Like, they were caught in fishing nets, a bit like, you know, the Starlink now, but we're talking like 15 years ago, right? They're floating above us and you start counting, you get to about 30 and go, oh my God, that's too many, you know, and then we just watch them go out of our way. But I'm watching these silver structured balls, and they were very intelligently forming, going over the tops of these trees, like playing with them, going over the tops. And I called the radio. This person didn't come up that's meant to come up. My boss did. And he's now looking at me, looking out the window. What are you doing? Come and look at this. So I showed him, and he went, oh, yes, unusual. And then they went. That day, and we can get that date, when I got back home, I went back to sleep early in the morning, like, let's say 8:30, 9 o'clock when I got back in the morning. I went back to sleep, woke up at lunchtime, and my ex-husband at the time said to me, Corey Haim from Lost Boys had died. And so we'll know now, if anyone Googles it, what date it was. I said, oh, right. Oh, I love that film because it is one of my favourite films. I just could watch that over and over and over and over again. And he lived in the valley. I was like, oh, I lived in the valley. He lived in Woodland Hills. Oh, God, that's crazy. I lived in Woodland Hills. Oh, my God. He died in Oakwood Apartments. Now, Oakwood Apartments, yes, it is a big apartment blocks, various places, lots of them. But the fact that he died in Oakwood Apartments on the day that I had a UFO encounter that morning, it linked me back yet again, my encounter in Brentwood. And, you know, I know with experiences, we have huge high strangeness with it. And it's just like, it's like them upstairs playing little games with us, or more confirmations that you are on your right path. You know, it's quite crazy, actually. Quite crazy. Yeah.
Interesting. Going back to Dolores Cannon, you said during hypnosis, you revisited your childhood encounters.
Yeah. So now I was going through when I went to meet Dolores, what came out under the hypnosis. Now, this time I was having major, major cluster headaches. It was horrendous. And I was having encounters as well at the time in the apartment that I was living in. It would be, there was one occasion that I had beings next to me, physically remember. This was without the hypnosis. So I had a lot of high activity. I remember Orion was very young. I was in the room that he was in, looking out of the window, and there was a church that I'd looked down upon the area. If I looked out of the window, there would be another block of houses there, then there'd be a road, and then there'd be a big, massive church. Seeing this vast triangular black object going very slowly over the top of the church, literally just this mass going over the top of the church. And when we swapped bedrooms to the other bedroom, that's when I had three beings next to my bed. And I'd gone to bed because I had a really bad headache again. And this was the time where I had looked into, you know, speaking to the doctor, saying I'd, you know, had a UFO encounter, and he was trying to treat me for, you know, like the radiation, my hair was falling out. Now, you've got to remember, I've got a young baby as well. So, you know, you could say hair loss comes from that as well. But I was honest with the doctor. So we looked into various, I think I went on homeopathic tablets. So I had three beings next to me. I will go back to Dolores, but this is all interlinked. I remember getting into bed, lying down in bed. I'm on the right hand side of the bed. And all of a sudden, boom, I have three beings next to me. The presence of them, I could see them out of the corner of my eye, turning my head and seeing them. They were pretty much in the same formation as another encounter that I had had only a couple of years ago to now. And they were next to me. And all I remember is then turning my head very slowly, thinking, oh, God. I remember putting my head looking up at the ceiling, and all of a sudden I felt a very, very sharp, like, needle go up the bottom of my lower spine, a bit kind of like being a mum where I've had an epidural, and it piercing into me, feeling it going in, and then feeling it as like a heart monitor again, like the TV in my head. I just then, as it went in, I then felt like, I always call it like a dartboard. It went in, and then you've got a ring of like where I felt it. Then that ring expanded, and then that ring expanded, and then expanded more to the point that then bang, I'm out and I've gone somewhere, or I'm out cold. That's with the beings next to me. Now, in the first bedroom where I saw the black triangle, I remember being able to go out of my body. lying down on the bed, all of a sudden taking a very strange gasp of air, which sounded so unusual. And I took a massive gasp of air, and then whoosh, as I'm lying down on the bed, I'm now seeing me float right above me, eye to eye, looking down upon me and me looking up to me. And then me above me said to me, "Beneath this one lies the true one." And I remember thinking, "What?" And like, whoosh, straight back into my body. So I was having a lot of unusual things happen, high activity. So we go back to Dolores Cannon. Dolores was putting me under the hypnosis. And under the hypnosis, I had so many blocks. And what I need to do is dig out the VHS machine and listen to them and watch them again. I've started to, but there's got to be a lot of information in there. And it would be nice, Nick, to actually kind of, I don't know if I want to put them out totally 100% public, because they're very personal to me. The same along with Bud Hopkins. But I always find it very interesting when I hear people's hypnosis and what comes out. You know, I just think, phew. And watching them as well. I have the visuals for the VHS for Dolores, but the audios for, you know, were Bud Hopkins. So with Dolores, I was being blocked because of these headaches so much. But what I saw under the hypnosis was beings working on me energetically. It confirmed my encounters in the garden where they used to take me, where they used to lie me down in this one part always of the garden, and fitting me with a box inside me in the lady regions, and a metal box. And I remember feeling it, not being happy with them putting it in me, you know. So there was a lot of crying. There was a lot of trauma behind it. And then also with that, they would become very close to me, as in visually. I had them looking down upon me. So when I say that I don't physically ever remember being in a craft, I've had lots of dreams where I've been in a craft. I've had lots of dreams where I've been working with the beings. I've had dreams where I've walked around a craft and looked out the windows and can see Earth below and see all the stars everywhere and see beings next to me. But those are dream formats. Now, whether it's a memory, but I'm just putting that in there. I don't physically recall me having being in the craft besides these. The with Dolores, these beings, greys, would be at this point. So the other beings in the garden where they fit the box, those were the light beings that I saw in Brentwood. These beings were looking right, I mean, as close as like your hand span away. And I would see their eyes so visually, to enough to make, when I looked at something, it made my eyes sore from looking at it. They were stagnant, real dark green. They were alive. They had an energy behind them. And then I was shown it without the lens. Now, we're going back to Dolores Cannon in 97, right? 97, I hadn't heard about this at all. So I was just going with what I was recollecting and what I remember of them looking over me. I was then shown the lens taken away, and then cat's eyes right in front of me. So I always call it slits for eyes. So I got, they showed me what was behind their lens. And like I said, I don't remember ever hearing about this. I was quite shocked by that. How, when I say alive, I want to say like the stagnant green, you know, where you had the shimmer of light on it. So I knew it was alive. I knew it had water in that eye. I knew it had moisture in that eye. And it was so close to me. So, yeah, that was with Dolores. Now, she kept asking the questions, you know, why? Why are you blocking, Bridget? Why are you blocking? And they kept saying, because she's not allowed to remember yet. Well, I was then retelling her, I'm not allowed to remember yet. It's not, I can't say it. I'm not allowed to remember yet. Yeah, that was quite interesting.
you have an interest in the paranormal, then you'll love the UnxNetwork.com. The X is your streaming audio and video for everything supernatural, strange, and mysterious, like UFOs, Bigfoot, ghosts, and so much more. From hosts like Clyde Lewis, Whitley Strieber, Micah Hanks, and Christina Gomez. Visit the UnxNetwork.com show page for a complete list of all the paranormal programs you'll find on the X. Be sure to follow us on Twitter for updates at KUNXDB. Follow our Facebook group, UnX Network. Find the podcast on Spotify, iHeart, Audible, and Apple Podcast. It's time.
It's new.
It's the X.
And when it comes to family members, are you aware of any of that? Have experienced anything similar?
Yeah. So both my brothers have had UFO encounters. I think one brother more than the other has had a lot of high strangeness and is quite open psychically. One of my brothers had witnessed one as he was on the train going to Exmouth over the estuary. I don't really remember him saying that as a child to me. It was only as he got older. What we did speak about was always the man at the bottom of the garden. My first brother, he had an encounter, and it involved him being in a graveyard. And it's funny because Preston Dennett's done a fantastic episode of UFOs over graveyards. And I remember, I think my brother saying that he stayed underneath this massive yew tree with his mate and hid from it. So both of them had, my mum, no, not that she ever told me. My dad, like I said, was very open. My dad was in the RAF. My dad's dad was a pilot. He used to own a airfield and fly cargo. My dad was very much interested in UFOs as I got into my UFO, let's say, witness support group. Nick always used to kindly give me a book to give to my dad to be able to read. And my dad was, you know, loved all of that. My dad was sort of like into, you know, pin codes, human pin codes, you know, like essences, like the bark remedies. You know, he had allotments. He was very sort of like liked all of his herbal stuff. I mean, God, he liked his whiskey too. But definitely dad never said anything that he had it, but he was very, very proactive for me doing it. Mum, no, but both my brothers, yes.
And your experiences, have they continued on?
So if we go back to what I told you earlier about the all-boys school that I used to work at, on top of the sofa, looking out the window, watching these silver structured balls, that was one encounter. And then I had, in the same vicinity, I used to live in this old house, and one night I remember going to lock the house up, and it was an old Victorian house, and I walked down the hallway, went to the front door, which was a glassed front door that looked out to the little front part of the garden where my car was parked. And there in front of me was this massive white ball that was hovering. It was next to my car side mirrors. It was high up off the floor and it was hanging there. And it wasn't lighting up anything. It wasn't lighting up my car. It wasn't lighting up the floor. It wasn't lighting up the bushes behind it. And this was late at night. It was a object that was outside. It was so big, and it was unusually big, and it wasn't lighting anything up. Staring at it for some while, feeling a bit unnerved because this house was quite in the middle of nowhere, and calling my son Orion downstairs. And he came downstairs and I said, come and look at this. And it stayed there. So we didn't open the front door. We were just looking at it from the glass, looking out. What is it? I don't know. And we're staring at this thing. So when you say size-wise, you know, like those exercise balls that you sit on, like some people do their like exercise on. It was bit bigger than that, and it was in the air next to my wing mirrors. And we're watching it. We're probably there for about 5 minutes. We don't know what to do. We're just staring at it. And then it starts to diminish the light. It starts to go down and go down to the point it just blinks off and goes out. And he said, right, lock all the doors, let's go around the house, let's just make everything sure that it was locked up, in which we did. Now, that house again, I'm driving to work, going to the boys' school, it's a massive long lane in the middle of nowhere. The actual area is called Beer Alston, if anyone wants to know where it is. It's going towards Beer Alston in Devon. It's on the outskirts of Tavistock. And driving along that road, and I'm doing nights there at that point. So I'm going, I think probably I must, maybe let's say I start at, you know, 9 o'clock at night. So I'm probably driving there about, you know, 20 to nine. And all of a sudden, as I'm driving along that road, dark at night, only me on that road, as I'm driving along that road, to the right of me, over the other side of the road, up high, I can see this light, and I can see this light descending. And this light is descending, and it's now again sort of by the tops of the trees. And I'm watching it as I'm driving towards it. I then pull my car over, I get out of my car, cross the road, only me on the road, cross the road, and I go to a gate that's there. I stand on top of this metal gate, and I'm now looking to the left at it. It's now coming down in front of the trees. So it's now in front of the trees, coming down like it's dropping. It's dropping down, 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 down to the point it's pretty much on the floor. This field had been ploughed, and now it's sort of coming towards me a little bit, but now it's going down away from me, down the ploughed field. It's like an energy ball of white light going down the field. I remember watching it till it went, thought, right, okay, get back in the car, went to work. On that same road again, I had another high strangeness encounter, which was, it was a Sunday. I had to go into Plymouth. I needed a printer, scanner, because I, you know, was doing a lot of the UFO stuff at the time, didn't have one. Went to a store on a Sunday, parked my car up, went to the store, went inside, and I went in there with the intention to go buy a printer scanner. A few people were being served. I didn't know what I was looking for. I needed to make sure that I spoke to a person. Everyone was busy. And it was quite late in the day. It was Sunday. Everything closes at 4 o'clock. So I probably would have been about there, I don't know, about maybe about, you know, three, mouldering around, looking around. And then it got to the point of, I knew that I couldn't speak to anyone. It was beyond me what I needed to know. What did I need? And I thought, you know, I'm just going to go. Left, walked outside into the car park that didn't have many people in the car park, got to my car. Well, it was like a Grand Voyager American Chrysler. So it was a bit big, slidey doors, quite high up. There on the floor, next to my car door, was a printer scanner on the floor. And I looked at it. I was like, what? Huh? I didn't speak to anyone in the store, so no one would have known I was looking for a printer scanner unless all of them in there were telepathic. And I'm like, what? Printer scanner on the floor? I remember looking around the car lot and thinking, is anyone watching me? Well, this is a bit weird. This is just like the story of my life of weirdness. I'm thinking, what? What do I do? Has someone left one there that's quite good? Thought, well, I'll just leave it next to someone if they want to pick it up, but they can have it. So I had a decision to, what do I do? Do I leave it there thinking, don't touch? Or do I think someone kindly left it for me there? Or is it a matter of high strangers? So I thought, well, okay, all right, I'll put it in my car. Put it in my car, started to drive home along that same road, but I'm now a bit more towards the old boys' school, driving along that road. And I'd had an experience a couple of nights before with another experiencer called Suzanne Chancellor. And we used to talk on Skype and stuff. And in a conversation, she said something. And what she said on about she could see me. Now, I remember driving around. This will be apparent in a minute. I remember driving around the corner because it was something to do with, we talked about owls, right? I remember driving around the corner and then all of a sudden it's dark at night, right? It was in the winter times, but it was dark. And I hear Suzanne in my head. I can see you. And then boom, right on my windscreen, a fat, big owl bounced on my windscreen and went off to the right hand side. And I was distraught. I was like, oh, my God, that's an owl. That's an owl. I pulled the car over in the middle of nowhere, right down a country lane. I pulled the car over And I got out and I thought, oh my God, I've got my phone out. I put this torch on it. I tried to see if I could see it. I tried to see if I could hear anything flapping, any movement. The grass was quite tall. I couldn't see it. Distraught, upset that, oh my God, I hope this owl's okay. I mean, to the point, I'll go back tomorrow and look. I got back in my car, drove home, which wasn't far. It was, you know, maybe 2-3 miles away, back to the place that I had this big, massive light that me and my son saw. Drove back in, print a scanner in the car next to me. I kept looking at it as if to say, this is just odd. Because it's the same, like, vicinity as a lot of my UFO encounters. And I get my son out, or I tell him, I said, listen, you know, I told him about the print scanner, and then something's put something next to my thing. And he goes, Mum, do not let it in the house. Do not bring that in the house. And he's a film buff, and I love my movies. And he kind of put it down to like the film Poltergeist with Carrie Ann and the dad in the sort of like the end scene when they take them back to the hotel room. That's the first thing they remove from it is the television, so she don't get sucked into the TV again, right? Orion made it very clear, Mum, that is not coming into the house, because it was just a very strange house. There's one other thing that happened in that house. In the same hallway, I was in bed. We were all in bed, and the little kids in the other room, Orion in another room. And then all of a sudden, one time, I heard footsteps so clear on the tiled floor downstairs, to the point of you knew how many steps were being made before it hit the bottom. Those stairs were then carpeted. So I heard these steps, and I'm downstairs thinking, what? Someone's in the house. Then I heard it go quiet. I could calculate how many steps, and then I heard a step that was then onto the wooden floor and then stepped into my children's room, young kids' room. I got up so fast out of that bed, ran into the bedroom, and my youngest son at the time, he was bolt upright in his bed. I switched the light on. He was sat bolt upright in bed. I just grabbed him and took him into my bedroom. And then I woke my son up, Orion. My daughter was staying away at the time. That was really unusual. That was another really unusual one.
The high strangeness never ends. To our listeners, if you'd like to hear more from Bridget, you can find her on The Naked Truth on the UNX Network, KUNX, which airs 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Correct.
Wonderful. Yep. And it's a weekly show.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I've had some fantastic guests on so far. And, you know, I've only been doing it, I don't know, maybe I think it's about 10, 11 times. You know, I've had Richard Doty, Nick Pope, Steve Bassett, Andrew Goff, Ted Rowe, Mike Cleland, because then I went into Mike Cleland's books about the owl scenario. Glenn Speckland, he's from the Adamski Foundation. So far, I mean, I've got some great lineup of experiences and researchers. So I feel like really blessed to be given this opportunity.
Indeed. I will put all links to Bridget in the description.
For me, even listening to people's encounters, it touches home, definitely. More so now is Nick, let's say 26 years ago, when me and you were doing all of what we were doing back then. Wow, how it is now in the last couple of years, and how exciting, even the beginning of this year to now, how it's speeding up for all of us, and just really trying so hard to say, come on, military. You know, it's funny because I didn't even say anything to you about I got arrested at Area 51. And that in itself was probably one of the scariest experiences that I've had. When you got a gun pointing at your head on the floor, I went underneath the gates at Area 51 with a load of people, and it all went very, very, very wrong.
Did they charge you with trespassing?
Yes. Yeah, they did. Yeah, I got the charge. The BBC paid it. 6 hours, probably about 5 hours gunpoint on the floor, freezing cold as it got colder and colder throughout the night. Right, I was asked to do a BBC documentary. It's available in some countries and not others, called UFO Conspiracy Road Trip. It is linked on my website if anyone wants to go and look at it. We started in Los Angeles. They took me back to where I had my UFO encounter, which was remarkable being back there. and just seeing the change in the road and various things. And then we did a road trip from, we did the Route 66 all the way up to go to Vegas. So along the way, we met some amazing people. When we got to Area 51, we went with a comedian. The comedian was the host of the show. And he basically said, let's dance into Area 51, right? Now, everyone's seen the photographs of Area 51, right? At the gates, the little hut gates that are there, and the bit that lifts up. Well, there was a load of us. We were on the bus. We got out of the bus. It's beautiful, broad daylight in the afternoon. Right, we go in. Andrew Maxwell was the Irish comedian that was the host. And he was fantastic. He put humour in every part of the way. It was a bit like put your foot underneath. Right, no lasers take my leg off, right? So we thought, right, let's go in. Pretty much all of us ducked under, except for two. One ran back to the big bus that we were on, and then the driver stayed in the bus. So now we're underneath that, so the arm that lifts up to allow vehicles in. We're now underneath there, and what's on the ground, sprayed on the ground, printed on the ground, is chevrons, right? So you've got chevrons there and you can see them. We were just being really stupid, so now we're underneath that part and then we can see the huts to the right hand side. We're like, okay, wow, this is bloody easy. What are they all going on about, you know, arresting in Area 51? And then you could see way off in the distance the cars, the truck starting to move. And like, we just see it. We don't think anything of it. And Barney Broomfield was the cameraman at the time. And we're all giggling and laughing, excited. Wow, we're underneath it. So Barney goes, well, let's go and knock on the door. I am as high as a kite on enthusiasm at that point. I'm like, yeah, come on, let's do it. So I suppose I'm the troublemaker at that point. So I said, come on then. So we go to the door. It's a little step up to the door. And it's a garden hut. And it had a window which had blinds in it. And the blinds were slightly open. I looked in, I could see two blokes sitting down, one's eating something and the TV's on and there's baseball. Great security. Barney then, I don't know if he puts the camera down or if he's got it in his hand, he knocks on the door. Well, within seconds, all of a sudden, these two blokes come out on the floor now. It's about 7-8 of us, right? On the floor now. So we just like move back a little bit. On the floor, I turn around, everything out of your pockets, phone on the floor. My phone goes down on the floor. Everyone's phones goes down or whatever we've got in our things. Lie down on the floor now. These two guys are over us. And then I am telling you, Nick, they come from below. No other way of saying it. Because we, even though this truck's coming down, I forget about the truck at that point, from there, because they're coming from behind me, because now we're all on the floor in a row. On the floor now, split apart, on the floor now. And we're like meters and meters apart from each other. No touching space, no can't hold hands, you know, nothing like that. They came from that hut underground. They came up. There must have been, I don't know how many of them came up. We all each had one next to us, pointing guns at our heads at that point, and then more came. So then you had the vans come. There was a lot of them running round. I mean, literally, we have our cheeks to the floor. We're looking one way, all of us, no talking. And at that point, it is shit. This isn't good. Andrew Maxwell trying to be the comedian, trying to say something. Stop. You know, no talking. You know, and our phones got kicked away. They took our phones, and at that point, I thought, oh, shit. Oh, my God, this is a problem, right? This is a huge problem. Becky, the camera lady, crying, hysterical. We're all in shock. And it's cold on the floor, lying on the floor. I mean, I'm in shorts and a T-shirt, right? And you can feel the grit, you know, uncomfortable and nasty. And then bit by bit, we were then allowed to sit up, face the same direction, which would have been pointing out towards the gate that we came in, the Rachel gate out where we came in. Bit by bit, we were allowed to speak. So they basically spoke to us, you know, where we're from, what we're doing here, part of BBC, gave them all the details. The director was one of the ones that got arrested with us as well. He gave them all of the details, and their big video cameras that they used got taken away. some of us wanting to go to the toilet, we got taken to the toilet and went out. And then I gave them my identification. And then the local police officer for Rachel then comes and gives you a fine. And you're there for absolutely ages going through all of the details. And I think it came to, I think it was about $600-700 each. All right, which is a lot considering all of us were having to, you know, the BBC were going to have to pay for all of this. The craziness didn't stop there. Then it was they're there now to piss us off. So that night we stayed in a lodges, beautiful little lodges. Well, we had cars patrolling the lodges. When we were all released from underneath it and all got given our tickets, we were then drove off. Can we believe that? What's just happened to us? And that night we were patrolled. That next day we were patrolled as well, to the point of ridiculous. A truck would come up to us, get out, point a camera in our face, take a picture, get back in again. It was absolutely stupid, really, what they went through just to say, you know, play with our minds. Trespass on military installation, as you do. But, you know, you can't be a ufologist and not have that under your belt, can you?
You should definitely get that framed, put it up on the wall, trespassing on a government installation. To our listeners, if you're doing the touristy thing and you're heading out to Area 51, or or maybe you're on spring break, you know, in the next couple of weeks, take heed, as it can be very cold at night in the desert and you could come away with a $400 even more dollar fine.
Please, listeners, take in my madness and all of the other people that were involved in the madness. No, don't do it. Because you know what? One, dangerous. I don't want a gun pointed at my head ever again. And yeah, it's very real.
Wonderful stuff. Well, good luck with the Naked Truth on Unext Network. All right. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Nick.
I really appreciate you coming on, sharing that for our listeners.
That's all right.
Keep in contact, all right? And I will be in touch.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. All right.
Bye for now.
All right, bye.
That is all for this week. Keep updated and connected with the show on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you'd like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com, or you can reach out to me via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to Bridget for sharing tonight, and thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.